Make your coffee, mate. Oh, what are you doing?
I'm leaving, mate.
I thought you were back for good. I mean, whatever I said, whatever I did, I didn't mean it. I thought you were stopping this time.
Mate, it's been a month. I'm leaving. Take that.
Oh, no.
Take that and party.
Party after the Giro?
Yeah.
Are you coming back, aren't you?
2 weeks before the Giro. As you know, I've been preparing. Well, the preparation is very much underway. We're about to begin our Giro Vagando in May in Italy. But yeah, it's been, well, I've had a lovely time.
Have you?
It's not you, it's me.
Oh, no. I thought this was almost cycling 2.0. Yeah, 10 years on.
Our time is nearly up, mate. But the hospitality has been, well, it's been exemplary as always. I'll leave a lovely review on TripAdvisor.
I can't guarantee
5 stars. TripAdvisor or Airbnb. We won't tell the Spanish tax man. No money has changed hands in the making of
Thankfully
this podcast. Yeah, but I've got a flight in a couple of hours. It's been a wonderful month.
We could do one last podcast, can't we? Come on.
Well, I think we have to.
Put your suitcase down.
It's a busy week. It's been a busy month. We've got a couple more podcasts this week. And yeah, now you mention it, I think we probably should do one more. I think young Richard Abraham is waiting for us. I don't know where he's waiting for us. But yeah, let's talk cycling, shall we?
Let's find out.
From the mountains of Mallorca to the moors of Yorkshire.
Moors.
Is that right?
Ont Moors.
To young Richard Abraham, who's joining us. And one of what's going to be a series of guests today. A bit of a sort of chorus line we've got today. Young Richard, how are you?
Good morning, guys. I'm all right, yeah. Good, thanks. Shivering
You're
up
in
here.
Yorkshire.
I'm in
You're in
Yorkshire.
Yep. Give us a precise location, please.
Wrong side of the Pennines. That's all that's important, isn't it?
Rob, the Pennines are international audience. We do have a very international audience. They don't know what the Pennines are. Can you explain what the Pennines are?
Some hills that separate the right side and the wrong side, right through the centre of the spine of England. I'm getting more northern, so I better shut up.
I love the way you've sort of leaned into the very thick regional accent as you describe this. It's all gone a bit by gum in here.
That's all for the audience. Gone saying that. You can't say that.
I need subtitles, Richard. You talk because you're at least intelligible.
Well, I'm down road.
Intelligent and intelligible.
Down road from Home Moss. If you can remember Home Moss from Tour de France
Come
and Tour
on,
de
please,
Yorkshire.
No more accents.
Yeah, stone's throw of Home Moss, actually. Do you remember that from the Tour de France in 2014? Glastonbury.
Not really.
Glastonbury on the tour, wasn't it? Big radio mast.
Oh, Home Moss. I remember Home Moss. Home Moss was a sort of iconic climb from the 1990, well, the Leeds Classic that used
yeah,
to
and
the take
milk,
place in the
Milk Race used to come up here a lot, didn't it? And so I'm just a little way along from there at the moment. Been doing a few interviews up here in Yorkshire for stuff coming up later in the year.
Yorkshire pertinent for what we're going to talk about today, at least in the second part of the episode, and well, pertinent with regard to a race that took place at the weekend and the winner of that race. Chaps, lot to get through as always. As I said, a bit of an ensemble today. We've got Lucky Larry Warbass, Decathlon AG2R's Motown maestro Larry Warbass, checking in not from Mallorca, not from Yorkshire, but from Sicily and Mount Etna specifically, Rob, which might confuse you because you were watching him yesterday in the Tour of the Alps. However,
everywhere
I spoke, yeah, he's like a rash, Larry. I spoke to Larry on Friday before he went to the Tour of the Alps, and we're going to hear that conversation in the final part of the episode. But first, we are going to have our traditional weekly news roundup. Richard, before you embark on that, one thing I would like to say is that it's the 16th of April, and it's Gianni Savio's birthday. Gianni Savio, 76 years old today. Of course, the Rob, what's his team called now? GW.
Shimano.
Continental team Continental Division team these days for Gianni, of course. Long-term manager of Sell'Italia, Di Qui Giovanni. Very good and long-time friend of the podcast. And our very best wishes to Gianni, because he is, well, he's had a bit of a crash. He was running, Gianni, 2 or 3 months ago, and he's broken a few bones, and he's sort of, well, he's holed up at home in Torino. I chatted to him yesterday, and unfortunately Gianni, well, he's probably not going to be well enough to attend the start of the Giro in Torino in 2 or 3 weeks' time. However, I did promise him that on behalf of all the listeners of the Cycling Podcast, I will visit him at home. If anyone's got any ideas of gifts we could give Gianni, expressions of our appreciation, our affection for Gianni that I could take to him, then by all means, let us know. But anyway, in the meantime, very happy birthday, Gianni. Richard, off you go with the news roundup.
Right, I've been sat on the start line, ready to go. There's a lot.
Maddio's birthday as well, actually. Is it? Mark Maddio's birthday as well, yeah. I think he's 65 today.
Well, bon anniversaire. Well, a lot to get through. Yes, you mentioned Yorkshire's own Tom Pidcock. Finally got victory in the Amstel Gold Race on Sunday. Pretty convincing victory in the end. No need for a photo finish. He beat Tish Benoot and Mark Hirschi, or the other way around, Mark Hirschi and Tish Benoot, in a sprint finish from a small group. Mathieu van der Poel, all eyes were on him. He was 22nd in the chase group, perhaps keeping his powder dry for Liège. We'll get on to that, I'm sure. The women's race, well, it was Lorena Rebus, or then it wasn't. Marianne Vos took it on the line. She, with a perfectly timed bike throw when Webers was celebrating too early. A name I've not seen before, Ingvild Geskjen, was third from... They're a young Norwegian, I believe. We'll go back in time to Wednesday and the race that kicks off the Ardennes Classics, even though it's not in the Ardennes, the Brabantse Pijl, men's race won by Benoît Cosnefroy and the women's race by Elisa Longo-Borghini. And worth noting there in the men's race was Joseph Blackmore, young Joseph Blackmore, a 21-year-old on Israel Premier Tech.
Is he younger than you? Younger than young Richard Abraham?
Yeah, I've just turned 22. No. Yeah, younger Joseph Blackmore. Fourth, very impressive ride actually from him. He's racing with the development team for Israel Premier Tech this year, but obviously dipping into the World Tour squad. He's not been riding on the road for very long. He won under-23 Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Saturday, just gone. A very prestigious, you know, race in the Espoirs category there. He's won Tour of Rwanda, Tour of Taiwan, and the Circuit des Ardennes this season already. So, one to watch. We'll get on to Flèche Wallonne, which is tomorrow as we're recording, and then Liège on Sunday. Obviously, the Ardennes week carrying on. A few more results to round up. Larry's at Tour of the Alps, so we'll get on to him. That kicked off yesterday.
Rob Hatch is commentating, I think.
And it was a stage win for Tobias Voss, actually. First one since joining Ineos Grenadiers, and Geraint Thomas was up there. Yeah, Tobias Voss. And day after Marianne Vos as well, so, you know.
Geraint, Romain Bardet, Bernard Cotton, lots of big names riding there. Bit of Giro prep for them. Last week there were some wins for Groupama FDJ in France. Lenny Martinez at the Grand Besançon d'Ouro and David Gaudu, Tour de Jura. Alexei Lutsenko won the Giro d'Abruzzo ahead of Pavel Sivakov and George Bennett. Stage wins there for Lutsenko and Sivakov, as well as for Enrico Zanoncello and even younger Jan Christen. We'll do a little recovery roundup, shall we? Now we've done the results. Wout van Aert is going to miss the Giro. That's been confirmed. He's been posting his little walks around his hometown of Herentals on Strava. He'll be replaced by Christophe Laporte. Speaking of Herentals, which is home to the cycling world's sort of going to bone doctors, isn't it? The Klaas family. That was where Remco was, undergoing surgery on his broken collarbone that he sustained in the Tour of the Basque Country. That crash also took out Vingegaard, Primoz Roglic and Jay Vine. Roglic is back home on the turbo. Less progress for Vingegaard, who I think is still in Spain. Scant details actually on his injury and the prognosis for that. Sort of reportedly, because he's injured his lungs, he's not able to fly back to Denmark. Jay Vine is able to walk unaided after breaking 3 of his vertebrae in that crash. Talking of injuries, Julian Alaphilippe released, told Le Parisien this week. Do you see this, chaps, that he's been racing the spring on a fractured kneecap that he sustained at Strada Bianchi. Some other news. key appointment in the UCI, chaps. I don't know if you saw this. The UCI has appointed a criminal investigator. Used to work for the US Department of Homeland Security. New post, head of the fight against technological fraud. Seen any more on this, guys?
Not too much, but it was very intriguing. Richard, the gentleman's name?
Nicholas Raudensky. He's come across from FIFA and UEFA looking into match-fixing, corruption and other ethical issues, I think I saw quoted. Probably a panoply of things in when football's concerned. But
yeah, it did catch my eye because it was sounded all very kind of John Grisham, didn't it? Quite a high-level appointment and, well, a gentleman with considerable experience. And this is an interesting topic. I mean, particularly technological fraud, lots been said and written about that. It's an issue that sort of, well, it's kind of faded from the agenda slightly, I would say, in the last 2 or 3 years. There's been some good reporting that's done by one of our colleagues in the last few months, Chris Marshall Bell, who's been investigating this issue. Talked to people who have been sort of speculatively linked to the issue of technological fraud in the past, and well, a couple of people who have been found guilty of technological fraud as well. But the issue of intelligence, chaps, I think this is something that people are going to become more and more aware of, particularly with regard to anti-doping as well. The International Testing Agency have redoubled their efforts on this front, I know, in the last 2 or 3 years. And this is an absolutely key part now of anti-doping intelligence gathering. And sort of anecdotally, I've heard from riders who have retired recently, and it's not systematic, I don't think, but certainly one thing that the International Testing Agency do is they conduct very in-depth interviews with riders who are retiring, have retired, to sort of try and mine all the information and all the anecdotal evidence that the riders have gathered over the course of their careers, with a view to this sort of informing testing strategy. And I know from a couple of those riders who have spoken to International Testing Agency intelligence officers that, well, they've been impressed and surprised by the level of knowledge of these intelligence officers. So sort of seen in that vein, in that light, I thought this appointment was very interesting.
Yeah, and whether it points to a problem or not, it's kind of important that the UCI is making this statement. And, you know, it's I guess things like motor doping, technological fraud is as much a matter of perception. If everybody thinks the riders are riding with motors in their bikes from a you know, an outside perspective for the sport, that doesn't really matter whether they are or not. It's to do with what you believe. And I think having this appointment is probably quite a key sort of PR strategy as much as anything at the moment for the UCI and the sport.
Another layer to this that is yet to be sort of peeled back, but I think within the sort of fullness of time we'll find out more about, is the Mick Rogers issue. Mick Rogers, former HTC High Road professional, T-Mobile professional, of course. Can either of you guys remember his exact title at the UCI?
I'd have to Google it.
He was sort of in charge of all things equipment at the UCI, and well, he's recently left the UCI, and there is some sort of suggestion, well, reading between the lines, there have been disagreements between the UCI and Mick Rogers that have led to him departing. And again, sort of, this is a complex puzzle, and I think we will find out more about what's happened and whether the technological fraud issue is part of all of this or not in the coming weeks and months.
Well, we'll wrap up the news with a few just other little bits. Well, good news for the women's calendar and the British racing scene, that they've managed to rescue what was the women's tour. It's now going to be called the Tour of Britain Women, 4-day race. It's going to go from Wales to Manchester this June. And well, Daniel, you put me onto this little story, not widely reported, but Piedmont, Italy, is bidding for the 2025 Vuelta. It would be 4 stages, it looks like. First time the Vuelta would go to Italy. Piedmont, of course, hosting a bit of this year's Tour de France, as I believe. Probably the third stage goes into, we say, Piedmont?
Third
region
and
the start of the fourth.
Third or fourth, yeah.
Yeah. What's going on there? Why does Piedmont all of a sudden want everything?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's part of a plan to have all three, to host some part of all Grand Tours next year, 2025. I mean, that's what's maybe surprised me or caught my eye most about this, was that how soon they are hoping this is going to happen. You know, we're sort of accustomed in the past, we've heard about Tour de France, Grand Depart bids for sort of 4 or 5 years down the line. If this were to come to fruition, it would be, well, it would be next year.
Yeah, something that we're not used to seeing at all. The level of forward planning in these, you know, Grand Salidas, Grande Partenza, things like that, Grand Depart, they all seem to have a 4 or 5, even longer term plan. You know, a lot of regions might plan, we would like to have this within the next 10 years. And to do it within 12 months, in Northwest Italy, with the Vuelta, it seems ambitious.
Yeah. Four stages, they'd be interesting stages. They've been quite specific about where the stages would go. And you can already sort of tell the routes, the exact routes themselves aren't known or proposed routes. But it's pretty obvious that there would be plenty of climbing, plenty of hills. Interesting little side note, one of the gentlemen involved, well, he looks after sort of communications for the Piedmont Cycling Federation, Ivano Garelli, he's also the president of the International Larry Warbass Fan Club. Wow. And I would suggest that this could be part of a high-level international conspiracy to ensure that Larry Warbass wins the 2025 Vuelta a España. Maybe later in the episode I will put this to Larry.
Is he going to hold the jersey from start to finish? Yes, carry it in a procession across Spain on the way back?
What's the supervillain in James Bond? It's Spectre, isn't it? The organisation that's behind everything going on. Larry's the sort of the Spectre of the Grand Depart bids.
Yes. But an intriguing story, I would suggest. So watch this space.
We and, well, there were some other, a lot of other members of the press and media were on the call a few weeks ago. And this issue, I think I asked you a question about identity, and it was obviously a question that sort of a lot of my colleagues wanted to put to you, the identity of this team and what it's going to be going forward. And it's a sort of soft factor question. It shouldn't be that important, yet, you know, you think about great sports teams and they do have an identity, whether that identity is built around a nationality, one iconic figure, in this team's case, Dave Brailsford, to a certain extent. After sort of 3-4 months in the job, as you're sort of thinking about that question of identity, has it changed? Has it evolved at all?
I think it's a really interesting question, and particularly when you look at us as a sort of you know, freeze frame moment in terms of the evolution of this team. I think our identity has grown out of the past of this team. I think you're right that you know, world beating famous sports teams undeniably always have strong identities, but I would also hypothesize that a lot of that identity comes from the fact that they're successful. It doesn't necessarily predate the success. It's almost the result of it, or the dividend of having that success. You know, and you look at some of the other team brands that are in the peloton that you know, you could have argued once had no identity, and you know, there's one just next to us here in Paris-Nice that have built a fantastically strong identity out of the success they've had last year.
The fellas with the funny helmet, I think you mean.
The fellas with the funny helmet. I think our identity is very clear. If there is any change to it this year, I think you might see us as you know, yes, obviously very Grand Tour focused in the way that we always have been. But you know, having said that, every race matters. You know, it was at opening weekend last weekend, and it hurts when we don't win a race. So every race matters, but we are a Grand Tour focused team. But we also want to be a team that's open. And when I say open, I mean warm. I want us to be a team that engages with fans. I want us to be a team that inspires young kids. I want us to be, you know, a team that you know, kids come up and they want our bid on, and you know, they want to ride for us when they get older and stuff like that. So I think there is an opportunity for us to be warm, open, sincere, engaging, more engaging maybe even with the other teams as well. But, you know, be friends with them, but still want to beat them out on the road.
Well, chaps, that was John Allert, the CEO of Ineos Grenadiers, the Ineos Grenadiers team. And we heard there a clip from an episode that we released last week for Friends of the Cycling Podcast, a Kilometer Zero that we called Diary of a CEO. Nothing to do with the with the podcast of the same name, dare I say slightly more, slightly bigger, more famous podcast than the cycling podcast. Is that possible?
Get out.
Yeah. Not one I'm terribly fond of, I must say. The Diary of a CEO, that podcast. Steve, what's the fella's name? Stephen Bartlett. It's a very big podcast. Anyway, that was John Allott sort of talking about his vision, Ineos's vision for the future, near future, midterm future. And well, in the intro to that podcast, which as I say is available to friends of the podcast, I remarked on the fact that Ineos had recently brought up their 500th victory in the history of that franchise, that organization. However, it had come at a time when Ineos had been struggling a bit for results, let's face it. And they went a long time at the start of this year with only 2 wins. They've got a couple more in the last couple of weeks, and some important ones as well. Rodriguez in the last stage in the Basque Country, and then Pidcock in Amstel Gold on Sunday, followed by Foss in the Tour of the Alps yesterday. So it was much needed, chaps, wasn't it, this win for Tom Pidcock. And Richard, you are in Pidcock country. You're going to tell us a bit about, well, some intelligence that you've been gathering over the last few days. But first, Rob, can you just tell us, you were commentating on Amstel Gold. What happened?
Well, I was commentating for the World Feed. I was on, I think we were on in the USA and other markets, not on in Europe, not on, Eurosport this weekend, but commentated both races, both fantastic races. The men's race is 250 kilometres long, so this is a one-day race with monument-style distance, really. 3,500 metres of climbing, 33 hills, and it's sort of, for anyone who doesn't know the Amstel Gold, it's got the climbs that are approaching the length of those you see in the Ardennes later this week, but it's also got the lefts and rights and the narrow roads of Flanders. It's a really... it's a unique race, isn't it?
I think I would hate this race.
Yeah, it's a stressful race, and it's not for everybody. You can't just say, I'm a climber, I'm going to go and win Amstel Gold. No, you've got to be able to fight for those corners. It's a completely different proposition. And we had four riders up the road. It was, by sort of recent standards, a bit of a calm start, really, in racing. Just four riders up, more traditional start. They got 4 or 5 minutes, but within 80 kilometres, they were already caught, and you're waiting. When's Van der Poel going to attack? When's he going to move? And Pogacar did that last year. He wasn't there to defend his title this time. But Van der Poel didn't go. His team came to the front, and they sort of hung around, occupied the right positions, fought for those corners. But in the end, it would be Mark Hirschi who'd attack first with about 40 kilometres to go, 35, 40k's to go. Pidcock, who we mentioned early on, has been on the podium twice here. Second, or was he second? If you ask him, it might be a different response, and perhaps with some reason.
It was a different response in his press conference at the weekend.
It certainly was, wasn't it? And, you know, if you look at the photo finish, it's still difficult to decipher. And he's also been third. He was third last year to Pogacar when he won as well. So he's been up there, he knows he can race this, and he sort of smelled the move again. He sniffed it out. He was onto it. Thijs Benoot was there as well, but the world champion Van der Poel wasn't. Group got away, and then it was whittled down to four again in the last 15Ks. Mario van Sevenot was there, and, you know, Soudal Quickstep, they've had a bit of a shocker of a spring again, haven't they? And maybe this is a long-term thing with them. They're turning into a different type of team now, aren't they? They're a general classification team at the minute with Remco Evenepoel. But van Sevenot was trying to pick up a result, but he was always going to struggle in a group with those riders. Lapeyrou, who's had some good results recently, he was chasing behind. And despite a couple of tactical games on that new finish, you know, the narrow road that takes them up, not to the Kalberg, but it sort of takes them to the top of it without going up the Kalberg, and then to the final kilometre, the games really weren't enough to let everybody else back in. There was going to be no repeat of 5 years ago when Van der Poel got back and all that stuff. And Pidcock, I think, was always favourite in the sprint there. He won the sprint. Hirschi second, Benoot third, and Van Sevenot let it out, I think only knowing that his best was a fourth. Lapeyrou fifth, but Pidcock finally finishing the unfinished business, really.
Yes, and well, as you suggested, Rob, this has seemed, well, I don't want to say overdue, but it's been coming, this victory for him in Amstel Gold over the last 3 or 4 years. You talked about the characteristics of the race. If there is a perfect race for Tom Pidcock currently, maybe in a second we'll talk about his characteristics and specifically what they are and what they lend themselves to. But at the moment, a rider who climbs as well as he does on the explosive climbs and sprints as well as he does, well, he's a glove fit for a race like this, isn't he?
Yeah, and all that fighting for position, he's so good at that. You know, the bike handling, you know, you've got things like the Amstel, so stressful in that you've still got parked cars on the side of the road and things like that in the Netherlands. You, how many times do we go there every April and see these horrible crashes and someone's spring or someone's ruined by it? And Pidcock is the sort of perfect rider to dodge all that danger, isn't he, as well?
Richard, I mentioned that you're in Yorkshire. Have you been, you've been fraternising with the Pidcock dynasty, haven't you? The Pidcock, yeah. The Pidcock clan.
Yeah, I was talking with his dad, Giles, yesterday. Who, well, Giles, a handy racer himself, and very closely involved with the cycling scene here.
I noticed yesterday, I didn't go onto the page, but Giles Pidcock, I knew that he was a successful local racer, but he's also, he appears on Pro Cycling Stats. I don't know what those results are, but anyway, go on, Richard. We'll look them up in while you talk.
Well, yeah, talking about all sorts of things actually with Giles, but obviously he was pretty happy for Tom at the weekend. I think really all eyes are on Liège this weekend. Just looking at Pidcock's results, actually, he's only won five races. He was second in Liège last year, but those five races that he's won: Strada Bianchi, Brabantse Peel, Alpe d'Huez stage, the Tour de France. Stage in the Tour of Algarve, slightly less prestigious, but now Amstel Gold. You know, he does pick him.
I'd say too, the stage in the Algarve, to give him a bit more credit than we're probably going to give him, it was an uphill finish. It was a different win. It wasn't a sort of, you know, the classic style. And he was up against GC riders. It was a tremendous win. And it's a funny one, isn't it? Because you can look at that and you see five wins. And I do that sometimes with Tom Pidcock, and I think, you know, we're talking him up for all these races, but we've got to remember, world cyclocross champion, mountain bike Olympic star, he's more than just a road racer, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think that's very much where he is. He's still only 24. With Pidcock, I can remember working for Cycling Weekly magazine back when Pidcock was a junior racing cross and he was doing his Superman celebrations across the line. And, you know, he was running those pictures big in the magazine. And it feels like he's been around for ages. And I suppose to an extent he has, but he's still only 24. And he's still got these ambitions beyond the road, perhaps not so much cross these days, but definitely the mountain bike. I believe he's going to be doing that at the Olympics, isn't he, in Paris in a few months' time. So kind of, I think, at that stage in his career where he's blending all those different goals, and a bit of a sort of multi-tool, isn't he, for Ineos. But perhaps not yet, or that GC rider that, you know, Ineos really a craving, I suppose, to fit into that team.
I mean, a GC rider that they're craving, and, you know, we heard from John Allott earlier, and we've talked a lot in recent weeks and months about the new regime at Ineos, the new sort of structure of things there, the performance director, Scott Draw, and I do know that, well, winning the Tour de France again is very much their ambition, and in the same way that it was their ambition when the team launched, winning the Tour de France with a British rider is very high on their agenda. And if you look around, I mean, there are all sorts of, it's kind of dizzying and bewildering the number of British riders that are appearing on the scene. You know, Rob and I were looking at the start list of the Tour of the Alps yesterday or a couple of days ago, and sort of new names kind of appear almost on a week by week basis. And you have to believe that in this generation, the coming generation, these are the kind of kids, I suppose, whose dads or mums often got interested in cycling, watching Cavendish and Wiggins, and who have then sort of passed this love on to their kids, who then themselves were also inspired by the same riders, Wiggins and Cavendish, and now these guys are making it into the World Tour. And you've got to think that probably there'll be two or three of them who are candidates as GC riders. Max Poole is one that comes to mind at DSM. Whether any of them turn out to be the guy that Ineos back, or whether Pidcock is the project, it remains to be seen. But I think that's it's a kind of interesting question. It feels a little bit churlish, you know, after Tom Pidcock has taken probably the the greatest or the best one-day win of his career to date so far. You could argue that Strade Bianche was that. To be talking about, oh, well, but what's his potential in the Tour de France? You know, really, I suppose we should be dwelling more on what he did at the weekend. However, thoughts will immediately go to that, as illustrated by the fact I saw that a few people pointed out on social media that Amstel Gold didn't get a lot of airtime in the UK. And obviously, there's a broader conversation to be had about the sort of boom to, some would say, bust of the British cycling, well, bubble. And it is kind of evidenced by things like that, isn't it? Races like Amstel Gold would never have appeared on the radar of the mainstream British media, and they don't today. And
exactly, that's it. And that's kind of why I'm here, without giving too much away for what's going to be coming up. But, you know, looking at what kind of registers here, and I think with Pidcock, you know, we do talk him up and we do kind of quickly move on from his wins, but I think that's because there's a sense that there is more to come. There always has been in his career. He wins one thing and you think, well, what's he going to win next? And then he goes and wins it. And I think I do get a sense with Pidcock that a monument is kind of in the wings, whether that's Liège, whether that's San Remo, Flanders or Roubaix, I'm not so sure, but possibly. And that's before you even talk about Grand Tours. But at least sort of where I'm sat, what registers is the Tour de France? And it's hard to understate the importance of British riders doing well in the Tour de France, but winning it really is what registers, and doing so on a British team. That's what was so key sort of 10, 12 years ago, back in 2012, 2013, 2014, was inspiring those riders who are now coming into the World Tour. I was looking at the stats. There's twice as many British World Tours riding in the men's peloton than there were 10 years ago. It's sort of just 33, I think.
And probably, then there were twice as many as there were 10 years before that.
Possibly, yeah. And it's this sort of legacy of the success in British cycling, but that only really works if you're winning stuff that resonates with the general public. And that is the Tour de France, and it's the Olympic Games as well. And I suppose in that sense, Pidcock doing the mountain bike at the Olympics is quite a sort of smart thing to be doing in terms of his profile here. But, you know, even if he were to win San Remo or Roubaix or Liège at the weekend, it's not going to get, you know, you'd be lucky if you get a report on BBC Sport, might get a few column inches in the papers, but it's not going to grab the attention like the Tour did and would still do.
And that, I guess, unfortunately says a lot about the culture and understanding or lack of it around the sport back in the UK at the minute.
Absolutely.
And this is something I fought against a little bit when I was commentating for the BBC at the Tour de France, and we tried to cover other races as well. I think Dan Lloyd and I were once lucky enough to be sent to cover Roubaix, but I think that was a one-off broadcast. The day I had a Dutch winner on the day. This is 10 years ago. And, you know, just selling the history wasn't enough, really. An hour-long broadcast. And certainly this time of year when you've got rugby during the classics, you've got football, you've got all sorts on at the weekend, the horse racing with the Grand National, the Masters that's heavily covered. It's a crowded schedule, isn't it? And the cricket season's starting as well. And that's a sport I grew up loving and playing. And, you know, I had wall-to-wall coverage of that alongside the football as well. And it is a really crowded market to try and get in there. And it needs for these races to become relevant to people, to become something in their imagination, and for riders like Tom Pidcock to get the rightful recognition that winning an Amstel, or, you know, for him, touch wood, a Liège maybe at the weekend deserves. It just needs time, doesn't it? And a lot of people talking about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, time, but even then, you know, it's not inevitable. It's not something that you can take for granted. I mean, I sort of harp on about it and drone on about it, but I've always got the parallel with Germany and what happened there with Eric Zabel and Jan Ulrich, and very analogous situation in a lot of ways. In some ways it's not, because what really brought the whole edifice down there was doping and doping scandal. However, you know, you go back and look at the German press at the time, some of the more sort of clear-sighted German journalists would often, and the riders themselves, people like Eric Zabel, would say, we have currently a Tour de France culture, not a cycling culture. This is a Tour de France boom, not a cycling boom. And it has, to some extent, been the same in the UK, I would suggest.
It's similar in Spain as well, let's be honest. We're sat here and we think we're in a cycling country, on a cycling island as well. We're sat in Mallorca, which has a track cycling pedigree from over a century ago when the first bikes arrived. And you know, you like to go trail running around all these little towns in the centre of the island. How many times have you seen a little concrete velodrome around there? There's a heck of a lot of them. But, you know, there's maybe one top track cyclist who lives here, is from the neighbouring island at the minute, is going to go to the Olympics. There's a rider that has been riding in all sorts of stage races, Enric Mas. But all the only talk here is that if he's going to win the Tour de France, it's very, very similar. And this is a country that's, you know, had a lot longer in terms of cycling history and a lot more winners than Great Britain's had down the years as well.
Yeah. Chaps, having said that we shouldn't be obsessed with the Tour de France, let's dive deeper into our mutual Tour de France obsession. Just thinking about the Tour and just thinking about what Pidcock has to do, bearing in mind that it is going to be an objective for him again, and his sights will probably be set slightly higher this year than they have been in the past as far as general classification is concerned as well. Now, in each of the last two editions of the Tour, he has been in pretty good shape for a large portion of the race and then has sort of faded to a certain extent. That said, 16th on general classification in 2022, 13th in general classification in 2023. Very, very creditable performances, which speak to certainly a potential. There's no doubt about it, a potential to do well in the general classification of the Tour, particularly when you consider everything else that he's had on his plate. The big issue for me, the big question mark, is time trialing. And you only have to look at his results, not only in the Tour de France. You know, he has generally consistently throughout his career lost over 3 seconds a kilometre to the best time trialists, and often more, a lot more. I mean, in the Tour de France last year, in the now sort of famous, infamous time trial won by Jonas Vingegaard in the Alps, and Pidcock lost about 15 seconds a kilometre. But this year, there are 60 kilometres of time trials in the Tour de France, more or less. If he was to lose 3 seconds a kilometre, you're talking about 3 minutes. Or there or thereabouts, and that's a lot. When you know he's a very good climber, and at times he has been able to live with the best climbers in the peloton, but he has never been the best climber in the highest level World Tour mountainous stage races. Chaps, we've got Amstel. No, we haven't got Amstel. We've had Amstel already. We've got Liège at the weekend. We've got Flesch. Would you believe we're doing an Arrivé after Flesch? Well, on my least favourite. It's not my least favourite. I kind of perversely sort of like it, hate it. It's so bad, it's good. It's so good, it's bad. I don't know which of those apply. The uphill cheese roll, the much lampooned Flesch Wallon that we've maligned how predictable it has been over the last few years. That comes tomorrow. Richard, you and I have the dubious honour of covering that in an Arrivé tomorrow afternoon.
Good luck.
Yes, but let's just talk a little bit about what we'd like to see in those two races. A much stronger field in Liège than Flesch. We've got the added sparkle dust of Pogacar coming down from the Sierra Nevada to go and do Liège at the weekend. He's not doing Flesch. He's not defending his title in Flesch. Van der Poel is not doing Flesch, which is probably a good idea because I don't think it would be suited to him. But who is doing Flesch? Who's going to win it, chaps?
You make a good point, Daniel, because I think when you've looked at Flesch in the past, there has been a... Oh, every point of yours.
He's full of them. He's full of them, the lad.
Go on.
When you know, you can remember lots of Flesch editions in the past where it has been a bit of a procession because it's just the strongest up that hill, the Muir de Huy, wins. I mean, I think of the women's race. How many years in a row did Anna van der Breggen win it? Lots. But with no Pogacar, it actually kind of throws it wide open. You look at who UAE are taking. They've got McNulty, Almeida, Fisher-Black, Ayuso, Mark Hirschi going pretty well again.
Former winner.
Former winner, of course. Yes, you're right. There's Benoit Cosnefroy, won Brabant's Appeal, Paul Lapera. Where did he finish in the end in Amstel? But fifth. He almost got across, didn't he? Fifth in the end. Yeah, quite a strong ride from him missing that move. But there's Alexander Vlasov, Peo Bilbao, Dylan Teuns, Ben Healy. I'm not sure who I'd pick out of that, which makes it quite exciting prospect, actually.
I think Dylan Teuns is going very well. We saw that in the Ronde of Vlaanderen. We saw that in Brabant's Appeal as well. And he seems satisfied with his performance as well. He loves them all, don't we? And you've got UAE, you can never count out. Like you said, you talked about McNulty. Wasn't quite there at the weekend. Ayuso, what's he going to come up with? Sort of guy you imagine has the explosive nature to be able to pedal away from the rest. Or it never looks like that, does it, on the Mall de Huy? David Gaudu's turning up after finding some form.
Pourquoi pas?
Yeah, we may well leave it at that, shall we?
No, I think it's essential. I think it's obligatory now after whenever we mention a French rider that might win a race now, I think it has to be suffixed with a pourquoi pas.
Yeah.
As discussed in last 3 or 4 weeks episodes. Anyway, go on.
Who else is there? Bahrain Victorious, they could do one of these big one day victories, couldn't they? They've been sort of thereabouts without having the greatest spring. They've been unlucky with injuries as well. Nomate Mohoric, he's pulled out of the race, although, you know, he's on the initial start list. I don't think he was a guy that you could have been looking at to win the race but help out. And I'm big on Decathlon at the minute. I think they're looking good. I think Cousinefroy is a decent shout. Outside as well, just with Alpecin de Koenig. I know you said Van der Poel wasn't there, but Laurence is, who's going well, as is Quinten Hermont as well.
This is why we generally don't speculate on cycling podcasts. It just turns into a long list of
let's
names.
Let's read everybody's name. Yeah.
Followed by, pourquoi pas? Why not? Why not him? Liège. Do you want to do the same? Just read off a list of names.
Well, Liège is a race that inspires me a lot more. Again, I'm in the Daniel Freiber camp on Flèche on it. Has never done anything more for me whatsoever, really. I will be watching, of course, as I will, but I think I'll be watching towards the end. In Liège, it's a proper race, isn't it, Liège? Anything can happen still. No Remco Evenepoel, but there is a Tadej Pogacar. There is a Van der Poel, and that's going to be the media build battle before we start, isn't it? You know, what kind of race is it going to be? But I guess that, does it have to be one kind of race or the other for one of those two to win, or can they compete on the same terrain against each other?
I'm not confident about Van der Poel's chances after the race he had in Amstel at the weekend. I mean, still riding well enough. I think it was 22nd or something. But I just wonder whether, more than the physical sort of decompression after his big objectives, I just wonder whether mentally the sort of adrenaline has tapered off a little bit and he's a bit demob happy, demob relaxed.
A lot of budget Vueling flights, as we established a few weeks ago, to and from Spain.
Yeah.
I mean, that does, you know, it's interesting that he's been doing that, I think, that he's been zipping in and out of Belgium and France, hasn't he, for these classics. And I think, I don't know, as well as the mental side, you do have to think about the physical aspect. He was pretty close to, I would say, top Van der Poel form at Milan-San Remo, and that feels a long time ago. That is a long time to sustain that sort of consistent one-day race form, I think. And this is the last race for him, isn't it, before a break? And I don't know. I think if you look at how he was preparing his calendar, if he was going to taper and peak anywhere, it would have been for Flanders and Roubaix, not for Liège.
Richard, you say zipping back and forth to Spain. If he was flying Vueling, it was probably more of a morale-sapping odyssey. On each of those two weekends.
I'm wondering if his bags were going to arrive.
Yeah. Anyway, he will be. Who knows? He might be sharing a Vueling flight with Tadej Pogacar, although Pogacar's probably flying from Granada on Thursday or Friday to Liège. Richard, we have got an episode of Arrivé after Liège on Sunday as well. And after that huge, resounding build-up that we gave our Arrivé episode for Flesh Well On. I would invite everyone to join us to see what we make of tomorrow's Arrivé on the Mur de Huy tomorrow afternoon, Wednesday. In the meantime, chaps, I'm going to get on a sort of figurative, not of Welling flight, maybe an Alitalia. Alitalia don't exist anymore, do they?
No, it's something else. It's got Ita Airways or something like that.
Flight to Sicily, anyway. And I am going to join Larry Warbass on top of Mount Etna in just a few moments. In the meantime, I'm going to say thanks to you, Richard, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks, Daniel.
And thanks to you, Rob.
Ciao.
All that nature has of great, all it has of pleasant, all it has of terrible can be compared to Etna, and Etna cannot be compared to anything. Who said that? Was it Larry Warbass or was it Dominique Vivant Denon, the first director of the Louvre Museum, writer, artist? Well, let's ask Larry Warbass. Was it you or was it Dominique Vivant Denon in the 18th century, Larry, I think?
Yeah, it definitely wasn't me, so it was probably that guy.
Is it true, though, Larry? You have been up there. You're our man on Etna, on the volcano at the moment. You've been there for 17 days. That's what we mainly want to talk to you about today. You're praying for the Giro d'Italia, so you are perfectly placed to tell us. Is it true? All that nature has of great, all it has of pleasant, all it has of terrible can be compared to Etna, and Etna cannot be compared to anything. Your thoughts, Larry, please.
I don't know. I mean, it looks kind of like a lot of other volcanoes. But yeah, this week it was interesting. I don't know. There was like, it was kind of like an international, it was a phenomena that took international news a bit. Like he was puffing these smoke rings. I don't know if you saw that, but I don't know. There was like this crazy phenomenon that happened that it's like super rare, I guess. But that was happening really a ton, like while we were here, was like it was actually blowing smoke rings, the volcano. So apparently like a new vent opened, and then it was like these tiny rings of air were like blowing into the sky. It looked like it was actually just puffing smoke rings, and it was pretty cool. So anyway, interesting.
But, wow. We were talking off mic, Larry, and when you announced to me a few weeks ago that you were going to Etna, I sort of grimaced because been up there a few times for the Giro. It's not an environment, it's not even a landscape that has ever particularly sort of captivated me or made me want to spend a lot of time there. But you happily have told me that you've had a very good camp and you've enjoyed your time up there, generally at the Rifugio Sapienza. Is it 1,800 meters above sea level?
It's 1910, so yeah.
More or less 1910. Okay, so tell us how it's been.
Yeah, it's actually been really good so far. So yeah, you know, I mean, I'd only been here like briefly in the Giro, and yeah, it was super windy and kind of not very nice day when I was here the last time. So yeah, I can't say I had the most positive memories before, but it was kind of interesting to just come somewhere new. And that was kind of like the team's thinking behind it, was like, you know, teams always going to Sierra Nevada or wherever and like try to keep it fresh, keep it new. So we came down here. Some guys came here last year and they liked it, so we decided to come back. And yeah, actually it's been really nice. So the cool thing is like there are just a ton of roads here, so even just to get up the mountain, up or down, there's probably at least six if not more different ways to get up and down, which isn't normal at a lot of altitude places. You know, normally you have one or two roads to get to the top and it's pretty boring. So in terms of like the just diversity of roads, it's been really cool because like we can do a bunch of different roads every day, new climbs, new places, and yeah, and then the traffic's not too bad. If you go into the cities, yeah, but like everywhere we've been riding is like not that much traffic. The cars go pretty slow. They actually go really slow here. They like, it's not like the rest of Italy. They hardly move. So yeah, it's pretty easy for like bikes. And then, yeah, I don't know. It's cool. It's just been different. And then the food up here at the place we're staying is really, really good. So it's been nice. It's sort of kept it fresh.
The roads, Larry, I would not have guessed that I would have well, I would have guessed otherwise that the roads were not good. Okay, there might be a lot of
There are a lot of potholes. There are a lot of holes, and the roads are not in great shape, but there are a lot of roads.
Yeah, potholes that I've seen in Sicily before, they can look more like crater. I mean, they look like, a bit like the crater of Etna's volcano, of, you know, Etna's crater at times. yeah, so, well, I'm glad no one has, you've all managed to stay upright on your training rides. I presume that's been the case.
No, there was one crash, but that's...
Oh. Without consequences, I hope.
Okay. Without consequences,
But I have seen... I have seen some very nice, I can't remember whether it was some photos or some videos from your camp, and you've certainly made that region and Sicily look very appealing. Larry, who are you there with? Who are your teammates up there?
Yeah, there are four of us riders here. So it's myself, Ben O'Connor, and then the two Perry-Ponts, so Aurelion and Valentin Perry-Pont. So yeah, it's just four of us riders, and we have one coach, one assistant, and one mechanic. So yeah, it's been nice. It's like a small group, but it's been pretty cool.
Tell us about the rides and the training. As we said, you're coming to the end of this sort of 17-day block. How's it been structured? This, of course, is all with a view to getting you ready for the Giro d'Italia. Take us through those, a couple of weeks so far, a couple of weeks and a bit.
Yeah, so there were two of us that we did Catalunya just before coming here, so Valentin and I. So we sort of started like a little bit slower, and Ben and Aurelion, like the first block, say we had a three-day block where like for Valentin and I, since we had just done a lot of racing, we kind of did like an hour less every day, but we did sort of an acclimation block where you're just kind of doing endurance and not a whole lot of intensity to get adjusted to the altitude. And then from there, we started to get into more intense riding, and we mixed between either two-day blocks of like 2 days of training, 1 day of rest, and three-day blocks, so like 3 days of training and then a day of rest. And we did actually quite a lot of intensity. And then, yeah, some long endurance rides. We did, I don't know, 1 6-hour day, 1 7-hour day. It was kind of like just trying to get in some good intensity, a ton of climbing, you know, like, I don't know, one day we did 5,000-something meters of climbing. Most days, like, probably close to 4,000. So really, really, like, a ton of climbing meters. And then, yeah, quite a lot of efforts and a decent amount of hours. So last week was about 30 hours. And then, yeah, this week we're sort of backing it back down just because we're all going straight to Tour of the Alps. And we want to kind of freshen up for the race.
It seems, Larry, just sort of anecdotally over the last 2 or 3 years, I've heard, I mentioned this, or we talked about this on the podcast recently, I've heard a lot fewer stories of riders getting altitude wrong. It used to be something you used to hear quite a lot, that, you know, riders would come down from altitude and especially, you know, the first race back, it wouldn't go so well. And on reflection, they'd realize that they got something wrong. They overdid it. They underdid it. It seems a much more exact science now, and the coaches really seem to know what they're doing. Is that fair to say?
I would say it's far from an exact science, you know. I mean, we still don't know, you know, there's still not even that many studies that show that altitude training like really works or how to do it or whatever, you know. So, you know, we're sure it works, but like we're long from it being an exact science. But, you know, we're getting better and better. And I think it's just like with the more experience you have, the more times you do it, the more you know, like, how to balance it. And I think now teams are doing it so much more than they used to, that they're getting a lot better at, you know, how to train, how to eat. You know, that's the other thing, you know, we're focusing so much more on nutrition now than maybe before, you know, like guys weren't eating enough or fueling enough in their training. And so, you know, maybe it just, that was sort of why it wasn't going so well. So, you know, you definitely have to be more on top of it in terms of like, yeah, your nutrition, because it is more fatiguing up here. And then, yeah, you have to be careful, like, you know, you don't want to overdo it or push yourself. And, you know, so sometimes like on the way up here, you know, we'll get to the last climb and everyone sort of will go their own pace rather than, you know, trying to kill themselves. So sometimes I think an important thing being at altitude is just being able to let go of your ego and doing what you need to do rather than, you know, trying to follow whoever's going the fastest. So I think it's just learning all these little details as time goes on that's helped us, and then I think probably the general peloton improve their altitude training.
Regular, do you have to have, are you having regular blood tests to check that it's working or that you're not overdoing it?
I wouldn't say I've done it that much in the past. You should. I think it's a good practice. And I did just do a blood test before I came here, and I'll probably do one after. But, you know, since I'm going straight to Tour of the Alps, you know, it's not like you can do it right after to see, you know, exactly the changes. But, yeah, hopefully after the Tour of the Alps, I'll do another one, and then I can see sort of what benefits it may have had.
Prior to going up there, Larry, things have been going pretty well for, well, certainly for the team, but I think I remember correctly when we talked in Ayres when I came to your house, which I enjoyed very much. That was, was welcomed into the inner sanctum of Castle Warbass. Things were going pretty well, and your training was going well. You'd made a few tweaks this year already, and everything was pretty positive. Has it continued in the same vein?
Yeah, no, actually, for me, it's been a really nice camp up here, and everything's sort of, really been going in the right direction. So I felt really good this season, and it's been nice because the whole team has been really going in a good way. We've had some good momentum, and I think it's been a really productive camp, and hopefully we're on an upward trend towards the Giro, and hopefully it will bear fruit. We will see.
Ben O'Connor, who is there with you, had a very good start to the season, has had a very good start to the season, Larry. Presumably, his goals at the Giro are GC goals initially. Yeah. Is that the plan?
For sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know if we've put a number on it yet, but it'll be definitely to be as high as possible in the GC for him.
And how's he going?
He's going really good. So I've had to let his wheel go many a time in the training. So he's in good shape. So I think he'll be really strong in these next races.
Excellent. Larry, I've actually got some really good news for you. I think you'll agree that it's good news. I don't know if you knew this, but so we remember the Giro d'Italia last year. We were introduced to your fan club. Your international fan club, which now your sprawling fan club. Well, the president of your fan club, Ivano Garelli, I think his name is, and he's a loyal listener. So our salutations to Ivano. He works for, he's involved with the Piedmontese Cycling Federation, who earlier this week sent out a communique about them being involved in a bid to host the Vuelta a España in Piedmont, in Italy. Yeah. So the start of the Vuelta in 2025 might be in Piedmont. And when I read about this and I sort of put two and two and together, and it was clear that Ivano was involved, I said to myself, this must be a big international conspiracy. That you're probably at the center of, and this is all, you know, it's probably a plot to make you win the 2025 Vuelta a España. So I thought that was good news for you anyway.
Oh, yeah, great news. Yeah, I did see that. I thought that was kind of interesting that they would try to get the start of the Vuelta, but that's cool. Yeah, it's interesting. It's different, I guess.
Well, Larry, this year, so before all of that, this year at the Giro d'Italia, of course, we're very much hoping you'll be present and correct. And of course, we'll be, what did we call it last year? Laranzando, we'll be collecting postcards from you along the way and checking in with you every couple of days. Larry, the next topic I wanted to discuss with you, because it's been a few weeks since we checked in. Your good friend, Joe Dombrowski, the third member, or maybe the first, of what I have referred to in the past as sort of cycling's answer to NSYNC, or our late great founder Richard Moore called The Young Americans, in a podcast that he did with you guys in 2016. Joe Dombrowski unfortunately has retired this year, former Astana, Cannondale, Team Sky, UAE rider Joe, and someone you lived with for a long time, Larry. He's been a good friend of yours as well for over a decade now, fellow Niçois as well, or Niçois by adoption. Larry, in a moment, I'm going to ask you what it feels like to be the last of the young Americans still standing in the international peloton, because of course Ian Boswell, the third member of that triumvirate, had to retire a few years ago as well. But first, we're going to hear a trailer from Kilometer Zero episode, so that's for Friends of the Cycling Podcast, that we are going to release in the next couple of days. It's called How to Become an X Pro Cyclist. There's going to be another episode that's going to be released at the same time, which is called How to Become a Pro Cyclist. This one's How to Become an Ex-Pro Cyclist, and it tells the story of Joe Dombrowski and his retirement. So here's a little teaser, a little taster of that. Joe Dombrowski is a familiar voice to long-term listeners of the Cycling Podcast. We released our first episode in July 2013, which also happened to be the Virginians' first season in the World Tour Peloton. What we didn't know then, but soon discovered, was that Joe was also one of the most thoughtful, engaging, and, well, human riders we would encounter over the next decade. He became a friend more than an interviewee, our man inside the bunch. Last summer, though, around when we were celebrating that 10-year podcast anniversary, in private, Joe began to fear for the future of the life that had been his love, his dream, and his profession. Christmas came and went, still nothing. Then, on January the 23rd, from Joe, a WhatsApp message that read, literally, "I think I'm going to say something tonight."
Broadly speaking, Joe, how's it going? 3 months into... Are we calling it retirement now?
I would say it's retirement.
Yeah. So how are things?
It's good. Not a whole lot has changed. We are still here in Nice. I still ride my bike a lot. Spend a lot more time on skis. I would say it's been an exploratory period where, and I think part of the reason that I continue to do so much ski and bike is I feel that I can think really creatively when I do sport, particularly like endurance sport. You just have a lot of time on your own. I feel that it kind of gives me this clear window of creative thinking where I can think about also other things that I want to do, you know, in the future.
So SkiMo is essentially short for ski mountaineering, which is basically going both up and down on skis. When you go up, you have skins on the skis that kind of allow you to climb without going backwards. And then the down part is skiing, just as everyone knows. There's different types of races, but like the race on Sunday, for example, being an individual race, you will start out climbing up. It's about 2,000 meters climb, pretty much with skins on the skis. And then there are sections where, particularly here, you go up towards the glacier and you might have to put crampons on. There might be like a Via Ferrata line at some point. So there is also a mountaineering component. Not all races are like that.
Larry, you are the last of, well, before we started recording today, I called you the last of the Mohicans. You're the last of the Americans, those three Americans, the three of you that sort of started your careers at more or less the same time. And you kind of grew up together as pro cyclists in Europe, in Nice. And you're the last one remaining in the pro peloton. How does that feel? And is it a scenario you could have envisaged?
Yeah, it's a little bit crazy. I don't know if I would have envisaged it, because I would say maybe in terms of like talent, maybe I was the least talented of the three of us. But yeah, you know,
really?
I guess that's how it goes.
Would you say that?
Well, I don't know. I would say more coming out of the under 23s. The other two guys were probably, you know, they were pretty in high demand. You know, I think Joe, he had 16 offers from World Tour teams. Ian probably had, I don't know, six or something. So I definitely didn't have that many. So I don't know, maybe not less talented, but just, I don't know. I didn't have the same, I don't know. Coming out of the under 23s, it just wasn't exactly the same. So maybe I had less hype, but. So I don't know. I think, you know, I'm just kind of a grafter. and still here, which is good. But yeah, I guess I wouldn't have thought it would be like that. I kind of thought we would have all, sort of kept going for the same amount of time. I think cycling's changed so much since we turned pro, and, you know, this whole push towards like super young guys, it's definitely changed the landscape. I think that's kind of why, you know, maybe even just how everything's gone in cycling is not how we would have envisioned it going as well. It's a bit sad that I'm the last of the three of us, it's how it goes sometimes. And it's kind of interesting because actually when I was in Catalonia, I was riding up one of the last climbs with Lawson Craddock one day, and we were just sort of remarking on the fact that of our generation of Americans, like we were the last two left in the peloton, which, you know, we're not that old yet, but it's pretty crazy. So I think it's just a bigger sign of how the trends are going in cycling, but.
Yeah, there are, I suppose, a lot of things, a lot of conclusions one could draw from, well, what happened with Joe, particularly last year. I mean, you know, we talk about it in the episode with Joe that Astana, unfortunately, for some of the riders involved, particularly some of the more experienced riders, turned into a bit of a graveyard because the team wasn't doing very well and the atmosphere sort of deteriorated, and a lot of the riders in the team, consequently, they found that their stock fell sort of en masse. And, you know, you and I have talked about this before, Larry, how, you know, you, I think by your own admission, generally you're riding in support of team leaders. You know, you're a domestique for a lot of the time. The way you're perceived is often dependent on how well the team's doing. And at Astana, the team simply wasn't doing very well. So riders like Joe were not in particularly high demand or in as high demand as they would ordinarily have been. But just watching the way things unfolded with Joe over the last year or so, Larry, have you sort of taken any lessons that you would apply to yourself or to your own sort of situation over the next, hopefully, Larry, you're going to be in the peloton for another 10 years, but
the thing is, I think I learned at a young age that cycling is a very fickle sport, you know, and I had a lot of rough goes with contract renewals, you know, and I would say there were quite a few years in the past where I was really on the limit of, you know, staying or going, and you know, not by choice necessarily, but I think, you know, I kind of learned that lesson really young, and so yeah, you know, unfortunately it didn't work out for Joe last year, but I guess, you know, I've definitely had a lot of experience in that department. My first years as a pro, it wasn't ever easy for me, I think I kind of got a shock early on, and it's something that, you know, it's definitely stuck with me ever since. So, no, I think I was more aware of it. Unfortunately, it wasn't super surprising for me. Just, you know, I'd say I learned the lesson a long time ago, actually.
I talked about that success, Larry, the team success, the team's current success. Your teams can certainly... it's had the best start to a season, I think, probably ever. I think I saw a stat the other day about another season when the team had started with a bit of a bang, but I'm not sure they've ever been this prolific in terms of victories before. There was another big result the other day for your teammate, a guy who you've ridden in support of many times, Benoît Cosnefroy, the Brabantser Peel. We've talked already this year, Larry, about a slightly different approach the team's taking, more focus on specific leaders or specific riders in specific races, a less sort of wishy-washy pourquoi pas sort of French kind of, you know, the kind of French modus operandi that we've maligned, or that I've maligned sometimes anyway, this idea that, you know, everyone at the start has got a chance, and or everyone in the team at the start has got a chance, and, you know, pourquoi pas, why not. The bikes as well, there's been a lot of attention on those, and I think it's well known that the riders in the team have enjoyed that change. But yeah, well, it's continued, Larry. It's continued, this rich vein of form. I mean, what do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it'll keep continuing, because, yeah, it's pretty nice. You know, it's cool because, yeah, it's definitely the best start we've ever had since I've been in the team. And yeah, it's just, it brings really like a positive atmosphere to the team. And, you know, I think it puts everyone sort of in a good mood. And yeah, you know, I think it is just a combination of all these things. You know, it's, I think, the equipment, it's the bikes, it's then, yeah, once you see your friends winning, you know, you think you can do it too. And I think it just really, it brings this positive spiral. And yeah, I think it is just, it's a little bit of fresh air, you know, and just the way that we're riding and everything. And I think, yeah, it's just sort of kept going in the right direction, which is awesome. And yeah, we'll hopefully it'll keep going in the right direction. So, you know, I don't want us to get too addicted to you know, I don't want us to, like, you know, then become disappointed if it doesn't keep going the way it's been going. But yeah, hopefully it will, because it's been pretty nice to be a part of.
I said to you in a message the other day, Larry, you're next. We expect minimum 2 stage wins from you, the Giro d'Italia. But yeah,
sounds like a plan.
Yeah. But Larry, the Giro, a big goal of yours, obviously. I know it's a race that you enjoy. It's a race you've done many times now. I was just wondering, thinking to myself, this week, while you're up there in Etna, obviously you train, you know, physically it's very important, the work you're doing now. When I saw you in March, we had a bit of a conversation about, well, we often talk about sort of mental approach to suffering. I remember us talking about in March, I think we were on the way to the station in your car. I don't know why we were talking about the trauma of suffering in bike races. However, I was just wondering as well, is there anything that you've been sort of working on in that vein that you're really going to try and focus on in the Giro this year? Any sort of tweaks in that direction or thoughts, things you're trying to kind of hold in your head?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I think, I work a bit with like, a sports psychologist, and one thing we were talking about is like reframing suffering as, temporary discomfort, you know, and I don't know why, but for some reason that really helped me, like, to be like, okay, you know, this isn't suffering. This is, it's just temporary discomfort. And for some reason, when you reframe it like that, for me, that totally changes it. It's like, okay, well, I don't know if it's the fact that it's temporary or the fact that it's actually only discomfort and actually you're putting yourself through it, sort of, you know, like, I don't know what it is about that. But for me, for some reason, reframing it like that, it's really helpful to me. So, I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe if I'm doing some efforts and, yeah, I start to really suffer or they're really hard or, you know, I'm sort of on the edge, I try to just think like, okay, this is like, it's just temporary discomfort, you know, I just tell myself that. And I don't know, for me, that actually seems to help. So that's something that I've been, yeah, trying to apply, both in races and, in training a bit.
I think we talked about how you tried a similar approach. You had a, what year was it, Larry? We talked in March about this fantastic ride you'd done in the stage of the Tour of Poland, which was...
Oh, it was in 2016,
absolute,
yeah.
Yeah, an absolute massacre of a stage where the time gaps are absolutely enormous. And we had a conversation in March where we talked about a similar, you know, you having adopted a similar approach back then, but I think we both came to the conclusion, or we started talking about how experiences like that can actually be quite sort of physically traumatic as well, and how it can be quite difficult to go to those places again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think your body does have some sort of muscle memory for, you know, if you go really, really deep or things like that. I think your body doesn't want to do that again. So it's hard to sort of convince yourself to be able to stay in that place. And I think it's also the same, we maybe talked about it as well, but like, it's the same for these really cold races, you know. It's like, I think when you are really traumatized by like a super cold day or a super cold race, it's like, I don't know, your body, it's like, you get scared for like the next time, and then, you know, you almost overdo it in the opposite direction. And yeah, you know, it's just something that you have to be conscious of and aware of, and yeah, keep in mind and try to not overthink it too much, I think.
Yeah, that inner wisdom of keeping oneself safe, unfortunately, it doesn't make you a better bike rider, does it?
Exactly.
That's not really what it's for. That's not really what we're programmed for. Larry, talking about a different kind of physical suffering, unfortunately, it's been a pretty rotten week for the sport in general in terms of crashes, some really bad crashes, crashes in races, crashes in training as well, in the case of, in particular, Leonard Kemner in Tenerife. There was a lot of debate last week, Larry, and I thought we should involve you in this as well. We ran through in the podcast last week, we ran through with Mitch Docker various things that have been proposed or suggested, whether in, you know, newspaper articles or on social media, what can be done to improve the situation, from a sort of equipment rollback, restricting gears, measures to stop this acceleration of the peloton over several years, the peloton getting faster and faster, courses being made safer, the peloton being made smaller, and so on and so on. What are your thoughts? What have your thoughts been over the last week on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, it's it's terrible to see, you know. You know, you'd never like to see anyone have accidents like that. You know, I think, you know, we're all very aware and conscious that it's an extremely dangerous sport. And yeah, I mean, I guess like we were talking off air, it's just, for me, it's one thing, you know, I mean, it's surprising sometimes that more things don't happen, because, you know, we're racing on these roads over hundreds of kilometers that are, while they're closed to traffic, I mean, they're open to the elements, you know. I mean, there's nothing to stop dogs, you know, animals running out or this or that or the other thing. And, you know, it's really hard to secure, 200 kilometers of road, and, you know, to mark every bump and every turn. And, you know, I think the organizers, they try to do a good job, but, you know, it's not always possible to really market to catch everything, sort of, you know. And I think, for example, in Basque, that was maybe an example of that, where, yeah, it sounds like what it looked like is like there was, yeah, apparently a big bump in the road. It was maybe from some tree roots pushed up, you know, certain something in the road. And then, you know, if you're coming in at 60-70 k an hour into a corner and you're not prepared for that, then yeah, you know, all it takes is one little error, you know, bumping into another guy, and then boom, you know, you saw the result. So, you know, I think, I don't know if you change, you know, if you had smaller gears, it was downhill, people would still be going as fast, you know. I don't know.
Are you,
you know,
Larry,
I
mean, have you switched to a 54 chain ring as standard?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even last year I rode 55 the entire year. So,
55, okay.
Yeah, now this year, because with Shimano, they don't have 55s, we either ride 54 or 56. So in a couple of races, I've ridden 56, and then the rest of the year, I'm always on 54. And yeah, I mean, it's, the thing is, the tires are so much faster, the wheels are so much faster, you know, the frames are so much faster, and then you know, also the clothing is getting faster and faster too. And then, you know, I think the next thing is everyone's going to start testing their positions in the wind tunnel on the road bike as well. So then we're going to get even faster. But I don't think that we should stop this technological innovation. You know, I mean, I think that's a beautiful part of our sport, is all the technological advances and all the cool things that we can do and all the room there is to progress there. But, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know what the answer is. I think the problem is, sorry.
I was just going to ask Larry, what have disc brakes done to the way a Peloton moves through a race, if anything?
I mean, we definitely have way more control. I would actually say in general, they're probably safer for like wet conditions, for example, you know. You have so much more control in wet conditions. And now our tires are also way better. And we're on almost all on 28s most of the time. For us, sometimes we ride 26 in the front, 28 in the back, because it's slightly more aerodynamic. But I would say for the most part, actually, disc brakes are almost safer because we have good braking in the wet now, whereas we didn't have that before. Okay, does that maybe make people go faster in the wet? Possibly. Or, you know, if you feel more confident in your brakes, yes, you're probably going to go faster downhill. And yes, we probably do go faster downhill. But I did see an interesting post by Nico Roche, who he was saying that back in the day when he started, that like the descents were a place to recover. They were a place to rest. You know, he'd go back and get bottles and you bring them back to your leader on the descent. And I do remember doing that. And it's funny because I would never think to do that now, almost, because the descents are such an important place to be in good position, because since the level is so high on the climbs and everyone has such a high level, you know, the one place that some people can make a difference is on the descent. And it's almost like more splits happen on the descents than they happen on the climbs, because the level is very like homogeneous, whereas maybe technique wise it's a little bit less so. We definitely go really fast down descents. But I mean, other than telling people that they can't do that, I don't think we're going to really slow down that much. So I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if there is an answer. But I don't think like trying to stifle technological advancement is the answer.
Yeah. Another thing you can't really stifle is the amount of information that's available now. You know, resources like, for example, VeloViewer are used because they exist now. They can exist now. The technology to create something like that exists now, and it didn't exist 15 years ago. So you can't really remove information from riders. But, Larry, would you say that is... Well, does that make things more dangerous, or does it make things safer? The fact that we often have the impression now that you guys are saturated with information. I gave the example last week of briefings, which last 45 minutes when they used to be 15 minutes, and team directors that know exactly where dangerous corners are and exactly where their riders have to be placed, and will relay that information, and this creates a what the French call engrenage,
I mean,
they make put everyone on their nerves.
I love VeloViewer, but it is also annoying because it stresses everyone out, because yeah, it's true, everyone has the same information now, you know. I mean, it's an amazing application. It's great, and it's so cool because you can really see everything. But then the problem is everyone has it and everyone's getting the same information in the radio. And I think it's just, you know, then the directors are getting more pressure from the management, things like that, that like, you know, if we're not in good position somewhere, it's on them too. So, you know, it's just like stress, and everyone's getting the same thing pumped to them in the radio. So everyone has to go to the front. And it's almost like sometimes if you don't have something in your radio and then you see everyone like stressing going to the front, you're like, oh my gosh, am I missing something? Like, I better also go to the front, right? You know, it's like, So yeah, it's bad. But the other thing that I also forgot to mention is one thing that really accelerated the descents is getting like maps on our computers, you know? So I remember, like I vividly remember in probably 2016, I was in Tour de Basque Country, and I was in like a gruppetto with Ilio Quesa. And I remember this guy was taking these blind corners faster than any. He was just dropping everyone. Everyone's like, "You're insane. What are you doing? Why are you going so fast?" He's like, "Oh, I have it on like, I have it on the map, you know, like I can see where, how, like what the corner is." And we were like, "Whoa, that's crazy," you know? And, you know, we just had the old school SRM without any map or anything. And,
I remember then, Larry, I remember a couple of years before that, 3 or 4 years before that. Do you remember a Dutch sprinter called Kenny Van Hummel?
Skill
Shimano. Yeah. And there was one Tour de France where he was sort of out the back every day, and he, you know, he went 4 or 5 days where he barely made the time limit every day, and he was doing these heroic rides through the mountains. There was a lot of talk. There were a lot of people kind of raising eyebrows about how much he was holding onto the car and so on and so forth. I think one rider told me that by the end of the tour, Kenny Van Hummel had one arm was, you know, a foot longer than the other because he'd been holding onto the car so much. Unsubstantiated that was. However, I remember Kenny Van Hummel impressing everyone by telling them about how he was taking the corners on these descents, how he was making up time, and that was a DS in the car basically doing the same thing, looking, watching the GPS in the car and shouting out, you know, well, over the radio, you know, left corner coming, right hairpin coming, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, for sure, but I guess it's one thing. I mean, even I see like here, you know, we're always in training, we're looking at the map, you know, so even on roads you don't know, you know, like, oh, I can go super fast to this corner. Whereas before, you would have never done that. You would have like slowed down, you know, because you don't know what's on the other side, right? And so that's probably also one thing that's contributed to a lot of like the way faster speeds in some races is just, yeah, I mean, we go Mach 6 down the descents because essentially you're just looking at the map and then you're like, okay, like, well, I know I can just rip it through here. It's good and bad. You know, I do think it's safe to be able to see what's coming. That's helpful. You know, sometimes I'm looking at the map and I'm like, why is everyone going so fast? We're about to like, and then all of a sudden you see everyone, you know, so it's definitely a positive, but this is also contributing to higher speeds and, you know, potentially more grave crashes.
But yeah. It's just a thought experiment. I think you've already really given the answer, but can you imagine this will not happen and should not happen, can't happen, but what would it be like if there was a race with no information?
I've actually proposed this before to my teammates. It's like, what if we just got to a start and we didn't know, like, you know, like there was like, say there's like two whatever stages to like Joker state or whatever, I don't know what you call them, in a Grand Tour where you have no idea. You only know maybe, I don't know, the length of the stage or something. And other than that, or maybe you know the arrival, but you have no idea what roads you're going to take. And I think it'd be kind of a cool idea, but like, yeah, you don't know if it's going to be a sprint or you don't know if it's going to be a mountain stage. But I think that would almost close the race off more because then like you couldn't necessarily let people go up the road because you don't know what's going to happen next, right? But
At Paris-Nice, of course, there was that stage on the last weekend that was it was altered because of bad weather, and I asked Thierry Gouvenou a few days earlier, he's the guy who sort of designs courses for ASO, what was happening with that stage, and he sort of smiled and he kind of winked at me and said, oh, it's going to be a secret, that's what we're going to do from now, and we're going to have secret stages. But it would be entertaining, but impossible, unfortunately. Larry, I'm quite envious because, well, you're going from somewhere that doesn't particularly inspire me to, well, one of the more beautiful races on the calendar, I think, Tour of the Alps. You've got that next week. By the way, you are in Etna for another 24 hours or so, I think you said. Watch your step because there's a very good webcam and I can see pretty much, you know, you don't need to be a member of the of the Stasi to spy on the Decathlon AG2L La Mondiale riders, because yeah, we can see exactly what you're up to on that webcam, which I was looking at before we started recording today. Larry, we wish you the very best of luck in the Tour of the Alps. We will see you in Turin for the start of the Giro. Very much looking forward to that as well. Very busy couple of weeks in terms of racing and also stuff that we've got going on. We've got an Arrivé episode coming out after Flèche Wallonne on Wednesday. We have got those kilometer zeros I mentioned earlier, how to become a pro cyclist, how to become an ex-pro cyclist. And then in the week before the Giro d'Italia, we have got 3 kilometer zeros for friends of the podcast. And the theme of all of them is the double. Obviously, Tadej Pogacar is going for the double Giro d'Italia, Tour de France. He's hoping to become the first man to do it since Marco Pantani in 1998. And all three of those kilometer zeros are going to be loosely connected, or certainly two of them are loosely connected to this idea of the double. One is very much connected to Pogacar. Final thing, we're also in a week or about 2 weeks, we're going to have our first kilometer zero live event, and that is going to be a virtual hangout with me and a special guest or two, and we're going to be talking about the Giro d'Italia. Larry, I think that's all from us. Again, wish you safe travels back to, well, you're going to first stop Italy or Austria?
I don't know, we fly from Italy to Italy, but I don't know where the first stage is, so
okay, somewhere up there. Travels to the Alps. Thanks, Daniel. And enjoy your last week of racing before the Giro d'Italia. And yeah, we'll see you in Turin. And in the meantime, thank you.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure to be here.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.